Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man I've had the privilege of working with and admiring greatly over the course of many years of his service to our country in that war, in a variety of capacities, in the uniform of the United States Marine Corps as a combat force recon Marine, as a SWAT team leader of the FBI, subsequently as a counterterrorism special agent of the FBI, and now as the president and founder of a terrific organization, Understanding the Threat, is John Guandolo. John is the author of Raising a Jihadi Generation and terrific blog posts at Understanding the Threat. I believe it's UTT.com. John Guandolo, it is so good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thank you very much, Frank, for having me. I appreciate it, as always.
Well, the pleasure is mine to have you, though the reason that I was most anxious to connect with you is not a particularly happy one, particularly for the organization in which you served for many years, namely the Federal Bureau of Investigations. We're speaking, of course, in the aftermath of the testimony on Capitol Hill yesterday of another special agent, Peter Strzok. I don't know if you had a chance to watch his testimony, John, but I wanted to get your sense of it, both in terms of his conduct, his testimony, but also what it says about the state of the Bureau at the moment.
Well, I think one of them, I did watch a good piece of the testimony yesterday, and I think what was most disturbing to me was Mr. Strzok's attitude and lack of respect for the hearing process. This is my read on it. And the fact that he didn't in any way acknowledge, at least from what I saw, any wrongdoing. I mean, he defended his actions, his behavior across the board. And I think, obviously, with some of the encounters, like his encounter with Congressman Gohmert, I thought they were outrageous, his comments.
Yeah. To your point, John, one of the things that has been troubling, of course, is specifically the extent to which he exhibited no remorse or even acknowledgement of the prima facie evidence of his bias and the fact that he insisted that it had no impact on the conduct of his investigations. You mentioned Congressman Gohmert. We're going to be talking about it in the course of the program a bit, but I was particularly struck by his introduction into the hearing record of the fact that Hillary Clinton had in these emails that were being sent around in an insecure fashion as a result of her homebrew server, as it's been called, that, you know, some sort of foreign entity was getting all of those emails, virtually all of those emails forwarded to them. John, from your professional point of view, the fact that he failed to make note of that or act upon that information in the course of his conduct of the investigation of that email scandal would seem to me to be a real betrayal of the public trust and the requirements of his office.
I agree. First of all, from an investigative standpoint, that is and this is a gross understatement, but following up on that is a logical and reasonable investigative step. What I also would say is this, Frank, and this is the real, I feel in this whole discussion about Mrs. Clinton and her emails and the server, this is the point I think is missed in many cases. And that is that when you take any device into a foreign country that is unsecure and the communications are going through unsecure means as hers were, then obviously, as has been stated, you're open to getting, your stuff read by hostile foreign intelligence organizations. But what Mr. Gohmert, what Congressman Gohmert laid out is something that begs the question, was Mrs. Clinton intentionally allowing her stuff to be forwarded to a foreign hostile power in a quid pro quo. Because if you look at the the evidence about the monies that the Clinton Foundation has received, then in fact you could say, did she send her information to Saudi Arabia? Did she send it to Russia and Russian intelligence? Did she do that? These are questions that the Bureau has not pursued, and I have not seen any evidence in the IG reports or in the stuff that Judicial Watch has pulled down. And I think these are very serious issues that haven't been addressed. And since he ran the investigation, I think it shows his incompetence as an investigator.
At best, it's incompetence. At worst, I think, as we'll be talking about with Joe DeGeneva and Chris Farrell of Judicial Watch, as a matter of fact, shortly, it's malfeasance. John, you, of course, had your own issues with the FBI in the latter part of your career, specifically in terms of what was being done by the senior leadership to dumb down the agent's understanding of and ability to contend with what I think of as Sharia supremacism in our country. And I just wonder what your thoughts are as you're watching this further evidence of, well, again, incompetence or malfeasance or certainly misconduct at the highest levels of the Bureau, add in James Comey, of course, and James Baker and so on. What kinds of reforms are really required in the organization in which you served, I think, with great distinction for a number of years?
I think the three most glaring issues, number one, above all, is leadership. The way that FBI agents are promoted to higher leadership ranks is, to quote the organization that the Bureau brought into it to oversee and to evaluate the way they promote people. The quote from the guy who headed up this, outsider looking into the Bureau of the promotion process said, if there was a worse way to promote people, we've never seen it. You guys are doing it. So that's number one. The other thing is the way agents are hired and the way agents are trained. So obviously, from my perspective, there is a just catastrophic failure to train agents, especially in the counterterrorism and counterintelligence realm. So that's the second thing. And the third thing is the way they're hired. The fact that the FBI and CIA allow people to apply online for hiring positions, I just always bring up the question, do you think Russian or Chinese intelligence or even German intelligence just allow you to go to www.chineseintelligence and apply online? No. When you hire for these kinds of things, you recruit people. You identify the kind of person you need, you recruit them. And what happened under the Mueller administration, under Mueller's tenure, is what he did was he went after skills instead of people. So we need people with this technical skill. We need this person with this language skill. And so they would hire them. And instead of getting the whole person as the type of person with the type of personality you need as an agent, you get somebody as a skill. And you end up in many cases getting people that are not strong personalities, that are not thoughtful, that are not discerning, and that are not, in many cases, team players.
Or loyal. You get Edward Snowden's, perhaps. John, we have to leave it at that for the moment. This is such important information. God bless you. Come back to us soon to talk about this much more, if you would, John. Next up, we'll speak with Joe DeGeneva. We'll get his take on the Strzok testimony and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and it is with the greatest pleasure I say we are joined by Joseph DeGeneva, one of the most accomplished, lawyers as well as public servants in the judicial space of anyone in Washington today. He is a former U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia. He has served as a chief counsel and staff director for congressional committees, including the Senate Judiciary, Governmental Affairs, and Select Intelligence Committees. He has been, in addition, a special counsel, so he has some experience with the strengths and weaknesses of that role. And he has been one of the most effective observers, analysts, commentators, and critics of what's going on at the moment, a topic that has sort of been personified now, I think, for all of us by Peter Strzok. Joe DeGeneva, it is great to have you back with us to talk about all of this on a momentous day after the Strzok testimony on Capitol Hill. Welcome. Good to have you.
Great to be with you, Frank.
So what did you make of it, Joe? This appearance at great length of a man who I think now is going to be the poster child of the deep state.
Well, a very important hearing, if not for the substance, at least for the appearance. And that was very important because what you saw yesterday was a seasoned counterintelligence officer lying to the American people and to a committee of Congress, using all of his training as a counterintelligence officer to try and transmit a lie and make it the truth. That, of course, is the skill of a great counterintelligence officer, even those who have fallen from grace. The problem with Mr. Strzok is he cannot be believed. What he has done is construct a narrative that makes him the hero in all of this. It is a wonderful display of counterintuitive activity by an intelligence officer. But thank God, since the 1970s, we've all figured this out. And what you saw yesterday was an affront to congressional oversight, aided and abetted by the apparatchiks of the minority, the Democrats. The Democrats have constructed what I call an idiocracy, populated by knaves, fools, and intellectual pickpockets. You saw some of those people on display yesterday with adolescent, ignorant, incendiary, inflammatory, divisive, and yet predictable commentary. Strzok's testimony is the beginning of the end because we now know that the Justice Department's Obama administration people with Bruce Orr and others were deeply, deeply involved in illegal surveillance of the Trump campaign under the FISA warrant. This will become the poster child of this entire scandal, as it has been from the beginning. And I think yesterday was a very, very good start.
You know, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, Joe, is something that most of us are still probably unclear about its operations. Just walk us through quickly the abuse of that process and the consequences of it, both for the Trump campaign and really all that has flowed from this allegation that there was collusion on its part with the Russians.
This is really important. From the beginning, in about mid-2016, when it became apparent that Donald Trump was going to be the Republican nominee, people inside the Obama Justice, FBI, and intelligence community were trying to figure out ways to hurt him. And one of the ways to do that was to take this babble of information about Trump and the Russians, that he'd been doing construction over there or trying to do construction, and to find out a way to smear him. Under the FISA Act, in order to get a warrant where you actually conduct electronic surveillance, in other words, you intercept emails, you intercept text messages, you listen to phone calls, you have to get a warrant. That warrant requires detailed information sworn to and provable to the FISA court. It is clear that in doing that, the Obama FBI and Justice Department lied to the FISA court by failing to provide them with accurate information about the basis for seeking the warrants. That's the first part. The second part, though, that's even more important, is that the FBI is allowed, without a warrant, underscore, without a warrant, to get basic data such as telephone numbers, email addresses, what kind of telephone calls were going on, what type of email messages were being sent without a warrant. Those are called inquiries. You go to the NSA with a request and they get the data for you. What we now know is that in violation of the law, the FBI under James Comey, Peter Strzok, Pry Step, James Baker were permitting private contractors who were in cahoots with the Clinton campaign to get access to raw FISA data identifying phone numbers and people, which data was ultimately spun back into the FBI to create false intelligence and thus to acquire the warrant which gave surveillance of Trump people who were then unmasked and then whose identities were leaked to the media. This is the core of the scandal, and it is now about to unravel. It is an amazing story of duplicity by the FBI, and what you saw from Strzok yesterday was an effort to divert, because he knows what's coming down the pike. And most of this, the committee could not get into yesterday because it's all classified. But they know a lot more than they're telling. And Chairman Nunes knows much, much more. And he's known it since March of 2017.
Wow. Joe, there's so much there to unpack. Let me just actually bring you to a related point. In the course of the inquiry of Peter Strzok about what he knew and when he knew it and so on, Congressman Louie Gohmert brought up some very important and deeply alarming information. I think it confirms what many of us have suspected, but apparently we now know that the Clinton emails that were improperly handled by Mrs. Clinton and her senior aides on what's been called her homebrew server were in fact being tapped, automatically forwarded on, I think in tens of thousands of cases, except for three or four, all of them wound up in a foreign country's possession. Could you give us some sense, as a guy with a long background, both in the law enforcement community and the national security community, Joe DeGeneva, of what the implications might be of such a compromising of her email traffic as Secretary of State for the national security and interests?
Well, what you've hit on, Frank, is the key word, compromise. Because from the beginning, the whole concern about a private email server in a residence for the secretary to use solely for her government business. In other words, she never had a Department of State email account. And you would have wondered, did somebody think about that at the Department of State? Of course they did. And they just ignored it and let it go. But her private server, according to the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community, which is what Louie Gohmert was alluding to yesterday, and it was a wonderful, wonderful set of questions by Louie Gohmert, who deserves a lot of credit for a phenomenal performance. What happened was the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community discovered that the private server that Mrs. Clinton was using had been compromised by a foreign something, government entity, non-governmental, NGO, foreign spy, whatever, and that at least 30,000 of her emails had been compromised. In all likelihood, those 30,000 are the same 30,000 that she deleted through the use of BleachBit and other processes. It means that all a huge number of classified information, a huge amount of classified information from Secretary Clinton's private illegal server were sent to foreign entities to be used to compromise her if she had become president of the United States. It also means that James Comey committed perjury when he said that they had no evidence that her email server had been compromised. It is almost impossible, Frank, to know where to begin when you discuss this. When you realize how broad the duplicity of the Obama administration intelligence, DOJ, and FBI performance was, it is staggering.
It shatters confidence, does it not, in our government agencies at a moment when we rather need them to be on their game? Let me ask you, Joe, we're almost out of time, and there's, again, so much more to talk about, but I did want to hit one other thing. Speaking of emails, speaking of compromises, speaking of foreign entities having access to sensitive information, I wondered what you made of the fact that the Department of Justice last week, as I recall, went to its knees, took a dive, whatever you want to call it, with respect to this, what's been called the House IT scandal, the Pakistani nationals inside 40 or so of the Democratic congressman's offices and email servers and so on. Joe, explain this to us. What on earth happened?
This is actually, as you know, this is the contractor, the Pakistani contractor.
A ring of Pakistani contractors, yes, to be exact.
Yes, and who have since fled the country, and the bank loans and everything. The bottom line is this. Jeff Sessions made it very clear after he was confirmed that he did not want to go back and review history. He didn't want to deal with old cases. He didn't want to deal with Hillary Clinton. He didn't want to deal with Debbie Wasserman Schultz and that server issue with the Democrats. The Attorney General of the United States has abdicated his responsibilities. He is no longer a functioning attorney general. Jeff Sessions has abandoned this president. This is very sad for me to say. I've known Jeff Sessions since the 1980s when we were U.S. attorneys together. He is a wonderful man. He is a lovely man. He is completely ill-suited to be the attorney general of the United States. He is being dragged around by the nose by Rod Rosenstein and Chris Wray. It is a singular embarrassment that he cannot function. And it's fairly obvious when you watch him in public, he has no footing. He has no command presence. And he walked away from this investigation of these contractors in the House for the Democrats because he's frightened of the possibility that he may be asked questions about it on Capitol Hill. It is such a sad state of affairs. And when the Mueller investigation is over, the president is going to have to clean house at the Department of Justice, and he needs to get rid of Rosenstein and Sessions. I'm very sorry to have to say this, but Jeff is not up to this job.
Joe DeGeneva, I'm afraid we've run hard out of time. We will be back to you for more updates on all of this. I appreciate so much your contributing to our understanding of what went down in the past 24 hours and what has been going on. And I know you'll keep up the good work you do at DeGeneva and Tenzing. Come back to us again soon, if you will. Next up, we'll talk to Chris Farrell of Judicial Watch about all of this and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is one of the great pleasures of being able to do this program day after day after day to talk to some of the most important, influential, and I think consequential people in the national security space, one of whom is the Director of Research and Investigations at one of the most important organizations in Washington, D.C., Judicial Watch. His name is Chris Farrell. You frequently see him at Fox and in other outlets. We're always thrilled to have him with us to talk about the important work that he and his team are doing at Judicial Watch, especially by virtue of the fact that Chris brings to this work a background in military intelligence, specifically in the counterintelligence business, which is a seemingly lost art these days. And I want to take stock with him of some of the things we've been talking about with our previous guest, Joe DeGeneva, against the backdrop of Peter Strzok's testimony yesterday and the questioning that was posed to him and the answers that he gave and much, much more. But Chris Farrell, thank you so much for taking a few minutes with us. It's always good to talk with you. Welcome back.
Thanks, Frank. Great to be with you.
So your sense of what Peter Strzok said, didn't say, answered, didn't answer, and sort of what it tells us about the deep state, which it seems to me now he has really come to personify.
Yeah, I mean, he's disingenuous, and his credibility is less than zero. He's an arrogant, smirking, really disgrace. And you know, despite the political stunts of Democrats, you know, standing up and applauding, and one idiot representative suggesting he'd be given a Purple Heart, what a disgraceful comment, given combat veterans who've lost limbs and eyesight and everything else.
Actually serving their country as opposed to harming it.
Yeah, you know, to put, for that congressional member to put him in that category is nauseating.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. One of the things that I was discussing with Joe, Chris, that I particularly wanted to take advantage of your expertise on was this revelation by Congressman Louie Gohmert of Texas that there was, in addition to the general concern about the lack of security in the Clinton homebrew server, as it's come to be called, and the arrangements that involved, as Judicial Watch has exposed to a fairly well, thousands and thousands and thousands of emails, some of them highly classified at that, that were susceptible to access by unfriendly types. And we now know, according to Congressman Gohmert, that actually all but three or four of those thousands of emails, some 30 or more, were automatically forwarded to some foreign entity. Chris Farrell, as a credentialed, trained, experienced counterintelligence professional. Give us your assessment of what the implications of that could be in terms of the Secretary of State's correspondence.
Well, there's two levels to it. First of all, there's the notion that these, not even the notion, I have it on very good authority that the emails went to the Chinese, or let's say an operating element of the Chinese, a cutout perhaps, but nonetheless ended up in Beijing. That's bad enough. But what's even more disturbing is that evidently reports were made from the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community to the FBI saying, hey, look, here's a real problem. We've done our own forensic analysis. We believe this to be true. Here's the evidence. And then the FBI did nothing. You want to talk about, the penetration, the technical penetration is bad enough, but the fact that the FBI, Super Agent Strzok, and whoever else was involved would then either ignore or actively suppress that information.
Much as he did, lest we forget, the Huma Abedin emails on Anthony Weiner's laptop. I mean, this was not an isolated deal. He was actively working on behalf of the Hillary Clinton team and campaign, I think it's fair to say, don't you?
Dereliction of duty is generous.
Malfeasance, treason. Let me ask you, Chris, again, if the Chinese were getting their hands on Hillary Clinton's official emails, can you just give us a sense of the kind of damage that that could do to the national security? No, without knowing entirely what was in those emails, mind you, but having a sense of it based on your experience in government and what you have seen at Judicial Watch as a result of your splendid efforts to extract this information from the State Department through the courts.
Yeah, well, obviously the classified information poses the gravest danger to the country because we know the 22 top secret SCI, you know, especially compartment and information emails or communications were sent across Hillary Clinton's server. That at face value is breathtakingly dangerous to the country. But frankly, you know, the intelligence services, even unclassified stuff, stuff that talks about, you know, what her schedule looks like, what her appointments are, what phone calls she's making, in and of themselves may not be the, you know, the most classified information in the world, but an intelligence service wants to know on sort of the broader mosaic of what is occupying space and time in her head. What is she busy with? What's important to her? I know she gave this ridiculous wedding plans and yoga routine answer, which is, that's terrifying all by itself, but you know, unclassified information is still incredibly interesting to a foreign intelligence service because they want to get the full picture of what that key individual is doing and not doing. So that's bad. But, you know, the breathtaking, the really shocking thing is that if they had immediate access or even delayed access to the classified information that was sent across the server, this is, you know, Pearl Harbor 9/11 level of danger to the country.
Wow. Chris Farrell, let me ask you, as a trained counterintelligence professional, do you think there would be reason to believe that the kind of correspondence Hillary Clinton had to have had on this insecure server about the sorts of things we've learned about, whether it's Uranium-1 or Skolkovo or other pay-to-play activities with the Clinton Foundation, that foreign entities monitoring her correspondence would be coming up with information that would be a bonanza from the point of view of being able to, well, blackmail her, perhaps were she to become president of the United States, most especially?
Of course, because, first of all, it provides leverage, right? It allows people insights into the not just the inner workings of the State Department, but also, what's the threshold for gaining access? It's even interesting to a foreign service to know, okay, well, this guy's looking for a meeting or a phone call, or they're a big donor with the Clinton Foundation. This is part of the problem of the Clintons, plural, both of them, you know, monetizing and leveraging their public service for personal profit. Millions and millions of dollars. And, you know, that's just another angle, another point of leverage against them.
And blackmail is a decided possibility in all of that. Chris, let me turn to one other thing. Speaking of all of this and cyber insecurity, the Democrats in Congress, many of them, were implicated in what has come to be called the House IT scandal, information technology scandal, as a result of bringing in Pakistani nationals to run some of their servers and email correspondence and the like. You, I know, again, looking at this through the gimlet eye of a counterintelligence officer, doubtless would appreciate what a danger this is. And yet the Department of Justice has now, you know, basically taken a dive on this whole case. What do you make of this, Chris?
Yeah, Awan and company had access to be able to sign in as any of the 44 members of the Democratic caucus that they worked for. So they actually were able to go into and assume the identity of those members and see all of their emails, all of the files, everything on the server. It's undisputed. It's documented. It's in the Inspector General of the House in their work and reporting. It's in the Sergeant at Arms and other House Administration Committee staffer communications. This penetration by the Pakistanis, the Awan gang, gave full access not just to the committee members that were the Democratic caucus members, the 44, but also to the committees that they sat on, things like foreign affairs and intelligence.
Homeland security.
Yeah, I mean, all these things that they were able to prowl around and look at all the documentation, all the emails. And so that the FBI decides to take a nosedive and go after Awan on, relatively speaking, a minor charge concerning banking irregularities.
And settle for probation at that. Chris, I mean, this is just astonishing to me. And I'm told that as a result of this plea deal, that it might even be possible for the Awans to be rehired by the Congress, or by these members of Congress, at least, to once again have this kind of access. Just very quickly, is there any question in your mind that if these individuals had this kind of access, that Pakistani intelligence would have known about it and might well have been running this ring as a spy operation?
The answer is yes. I mean, it could be. I don't know whether they were the Awan gang was under the direct operational control of ISI, or whether they were simply, you know, selling it to them. But nonetheless, based upon the download information that we know, all the stuff that came off that server, and the fact that once the server disappeared, they lost it.
Chris Farrell, if it weren't for Judicial Watch, I think it's fair to say there would be even more of this kind of malfeasance on the part of individuals like Peter Strzok, but also institutions like the one he worked for. And I appreciate you coming aboard every once in a while to share with us your findings and thinking. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Matt Brodsky right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined by Matthew J. Brodsky. He is these days a senior Middle East analyst at Wikistrat. He is also a senior fellow at the Strategic Studies Group. He is a man of some accomplishment, both in the business of public policy commentary as well as analysis, and I'm anxious to catch up with him about one of his recent products at the Strategic Studies Group entitled Resolving the Israel-Palestinian Conflict. Matt, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, as always.
Well, I wanted to sort of explore with you what you've published in this paper, Matt, the principal thrust of which is that there's a lot of history here. This is my words, not yours, obviously, but a lot of history here. And you've I think, helpfully charted, you know, what are the various issues, how have they developed over time, the so-called final status issues specifically, with a view to seeing if you could sort of advance some ideas as to how they might be resolved. My own feeling about this is, and that of others that I respect, has been that this isn't actually a problem of final status. This is a problem of a lack of shared interest on the part of Israelis and at least the Palestinian leadership, such as it is, in having peace. Walk us through how you sort of came to the conclusion that if only we could just get sort of the particulars down, this would be something that was amenable to a negotiated settlement when there really doesn't seem to be much of a shared commitment to peace among the two parties.
Well, to be very clear, I don't conclude that this is, in fact, the best path. What I do say, and very specifically in the introduction and toward the end, is that if the Trump administration is going to lay down a two-state solution, then what we were going to do at the Security Studies Group was take a look at the past history of the three major efforts that took place in 2000 and 2008 and 2014, and look at where those the main issues were: Jerusalem, refugees, borders, security, and then see what a two-state solution would look like, essentially. Now, as to what you were saying, what the problems, the underlying problems, I agree wholeheartedly. And I mean, I don't know or believe that it's a good time to actually put forward an administration plan unless it's heavily tilted toward Israel. But yes, the underlying problem is Israel's existence from the Palestinians' perspective, which is to say, it's not about territory, it's not about borders, it's not about the 1967, what they call the occupation. It's about 1948 and the fact that Israel exists. From the Israeli side, of course, they don't feel like getting too involved in a negotiation right now, because why would they possibly believe that they have a partner?
Well, I think then we are probably less far apart than I had thought, Matt Brodsky. I would just simply say, what I just have misgivings about, I must say, and I think this isn't the first time I've had them with some of your team there, is rather than argue against a bad policy approach, you seem to be trying to advance ways in which it might be made a little less bad. But fundamentally, I think of it as our job, if the administration is seemingly poised to make a mistake, to tell them don't do it, warn them against doing it, make the case that this would be folly, in fact, to embark upon, rather than seemingly offering constructive ideas, as you wish, that I don't think are actually going to advance the cause of peace at all, but may create once again, Matt, this idea that there is a peace process worthy of the name, when there's no evidence of that at all, as far as I can tell, as long as one of the parties, the Palestinians, are absolutely determined not to have peace. And again, it's not about the particulars of the deal. It's that they don't believe, and I think rightly so, they could survive making peace with the Israelis, given the character of the radical, you know, population that they have been cultivating and otherwise enabling for decades.
Right. I think if you look at my writing, I've been very consistent on where I stand on the issue. And I don't actually believe myself that it is that there a two-state solution is currently within the offing. Now, that said, I think that the utility of what we have written is to basically remind people of what those issues are and what the final status issues essentially are going to look like, because it's more or less something along the lines of what the administration were to put out, would put out, we believe, if it were to be a two-state solution. I also believe that it would be very constructive to also explore other solutions, and I'd be happy to write that. But I certainly take your point. It's really a plan that shows the history of negotiations, what the issues are, the four main issues, and then to put together what would likely come out as a plan for two states.
It's a non-starter, is my concern. And I think, as you say, Matt, overwhelmingly your analysis of this jives with that. And we just shouldn't be encouraging people to make ill-advised initiatives, I think, that will be, at the end, counterproductive. But let me switch gears, because you've also been writing on something else that's very topical at the moment, and I wanted to sort of expose our audience to some of your analysis there. And that is the prospect that what Iran is up to in Syria in terms of bringing its military ever closer to the border of Israel, and whether in its own, you know, formal military configuration or through its proxies, Hezbollah, is increasingly posing a threat to not just the Golan, but to Israel proper from that territory, prompting the Israelis to take some rather dramatic actions against both the Iranians and the Syrians. This has come to a head recently in connection with some drone operations, both Syrian and Iranian, aimed at Israel. Talk a little bit about what's afoot there with respect to the drones in particular, Matt Brodsky, as well as more broadly what the Iranians are up to and what the Israelis are going to do about it.
Well, in the report I just did with Jonathan Shanzer and Tony Medrano of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, we're looking at the new rules of the game that are going to exist between Israel and Syria and Iran and Russia, of course. So you have Iran is basically there to stay. Israel would like to prevent it. Now, lately, in the past few days, we've seen Syrian drones coming over into northern Israel that are a part of the offensive that Assad has planned down there. So Israel is basically juggling between having to make a deal with Putin where they say that Iran needs to leave the country, but Israel will not go after Assad unless targeted by Assad. So in the meantime, the past two drone infiltrations from this week have been Syrian. The Israeli Defense Forces have been clear in showing that they are Syrian, and then they've attacked Syrian assets, which means they're probably not going to tolerate that much longer before having to send a much more stronger message to Russia through action as opposed to yet another meeting. When it comes to Iran, anytime Iran will launch a drone or become exposed or do anything to threaten Israel from Syria, Israel is going to respond by a much greater margin. If you were to look at a ratio, say like a 3-to-1 ratio, because what they're trying to do is make sure that they leave. Keeping it as a low intensity tit for tat attack structure that's currently what we've seen will not work out to Israel's interest. And of course, Hamas, also under the sway of Iran and in Gaza, does the same type of calculations when it comes to fire kites and trying to get through the fence and attack Israelis and their own drones.
Yeah. This fire kite business, by the way, is of great concern. I know they're doing a lot of damage. These are simply kites that are, I guess, on fire, or at least cause fire to be lit when they crash into Israeli forests or buildings or other things, as I understand it. And Matt Brodsky, what you're describing, again, whether it's the drones from Hamas or the drones from Syria or the drones from Iran or any of the myriad other threats, including the more conventional or prosaic terrorist actions, just further evidence of how far Israel is from being able to make peace with people in this part of the world, and why I think we've got to stand shoulder to shoulder with them in defending themselves against these threats at a time when that's really the focus, not a peace process. We have to leave it at that for the moment, my friend. I appreciate so much your time. Thank you very much for joining us, Matt. It's good to talk with you as always, and I hope we'll do so again soon. I hope we'll talk with the rest of you again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.